Hi, everybody, and thank you for joining us for the Preceptor Podcast. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Ryan, and today we have with us a returning guest, Dr. Alex Mills. Alex, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, hey, everyone. I am here down at the University of Mississippi School of Pharmacy. I'm a faculty member here, as well as I practice in ambulatory care, particularly taking care of persons living with HIV, as well as I'm the director of clinical operations for a sexual and gender minority clinic here at the University of Mississippi Medical Center. So thanks for having me back.
I think your title has increased since the last time we had you.
Yeah, I guess so.
Well, I reached out to Alex because there was a couple reports of spontaneous cures of HIV in the lay media. And I kind of felt like this seems like it's too good to be true. There's probably more to this. And I reached out to Alex just to get some more information and to see what's going on with this. So Alex, can you tell us what happened in these cases?
Yeah, let's just jump right to the $1 million question, huh? Yeah, I mean, so a little bit of background for those who may not be aware of this. There was a report, I think it was in the Annals of Internal Medicine, about a woman from Argentina, and she was dubbed the Esperanza patient, who was, after being diagnosed with HIV back in 2013 and gave birth to a child who was HIV negative, she remained undetectable without being on any HIV antiretrovirals. And again, many, many tests have been done with various cell lines for her to attempt to find the virus, see if there's any trace of it. Yet it pretty much appears to be completely eradicated from her body, for lack of a better word, which is simply amazing, right? And while she was on treatment, though, I will say for 6 months through the end of her pregnancy, those were stopped. And then she continued to remain negative. And then there's been also another patient that we were talking about too, Sarah, that was had a similar results called the San Francisco patients. Both of these patients were named from where they were living at the time. She was also infected with HIV, but there were some differences that they were able to find in her, actually her DNA and some of her genetic code, that appeared to allow HIV to live in what they call gene deserts. And, you know, I'm as much of an expert I am as on HIV, gene deserts I'm not, but it sounds like it's these essentially these areas that really these fine pockets that the virus is essentially trapped in, unable to replicate, unable to get into any other parts of the body that would be more functional. So essentially, both of these patients fall into this obviously incredibly rare subset of persons living with HIV that we call elite controllers, which is about less than 1% of those with HIV. But actually, these patients are labeled now as extraordinary elite controllers. And the thing that makes it so extraordinary is with elite controllers that are suppressed without being on antiretroviral therapy, they still will have markers of immune hyperactivation, which they still have increased risk for different conditions, such as an increase in cardiovascular events. And so they eventually do have a rebound in their viral load and become detectable once again. But these two persons do not show any signs of that immune reactivation. So we currently don't anticipate them having any sort of resurgence or rebound at this time. Now, I'd argue if this is truly the case, then we should probably call these patients more elite eradicators, not elite controllers. If they show all the other same signs as a elite controller. So basically, I guess you could say for now that these two patients are cured.
That's really just simply amazing. And so that leads me to my next question, and I think you touched on it a little bit here, but do scientists know exactly how this occurs, or what predispositions a patient might have that would put them at a better chance of being one of these eradicators, for lack of a better term?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely have some interesting theories, but nothing definitive. So one that we have that's related to what we see in elite controllers historically are that they have these very potent CD8 T cells, which are, again, part of the two types of main white blood cells that we'd see in a patient who has HIV that's affected. And so they're seen to be much more potent and are able to potentially identify, maybe quickly kill those CD4 cells that we typically think about with HIV earlier on. Now, the only issue, though, with that theory is that our now eradicators, as we're going to call them for this, is that if scientists don't see any trace of viral proteins or anything of the virus in these patients' functional cells, then as you can imagine, their immune system wouldn't know to attack those cells because there's nothing that makes them seem foreign to the immune system. The other interesting thing that was shown in, you know, these particular cells for the Esperanza patient, they took out some of her CD4 cells in vitro, put them in a dish, in a test tube essentially, and they were able to easily infect those cells with HIV. So her CD4 cells aren't resistant to the HIV virus. And the other theory that's probably the most of interest right now and has the most traction is related to like a successful HIV specific immune response. So we do know that she had a partner who had HIV prior to her and unfortunately passed due to complications related to HIV. So then there's this question of, did some exposure from her partner lead to this very unique, you know, essentially one in a million response, HIV immune response to that HIV that prevented primary infection, prevented that viral reservoir that formed in this patient. So in that case, the next steps would really be, okay, can we isolate part of her immune system using like humanized mice models? Because of course, ethically, we're not gonna go ahead and say, okay, let's try to take some of your immune systems and put it into another human and just see if we get you infected, right? Probably not gonna work ethically, but testing to see, you know, if we try that in a humanized mice and expose the mice to HIV, what necessarily will be the result? But again, as you can imagine too, this is a very difficult process, has limited success with other conditions that they've tried this in the past. We have had some theories with one other type of patient that you could say has been cured from HIV, which was labeled the Berlin patient. He was a little also unique in the fact that he required radiation in the bone marrow transplant for a blood cancer, a leukemia. And that particular stem cell transplant, bone marrow transplant that he had a mutation in this one particular receptor, CCR5, which is what we use, or what HIV uses to enter a T cell. So in that case, you know, we have medications now because of the Berlin patient for HIV that are related to that particular CCR5 co-receptor. But when we've tried that in patients living with HIV, it does not necessarily lead to a cure. It's again, just a suppression. And again, as you can imagine, we're not necessarily going to do as intense of a treatment that the Berlin patient had of irradiating a patient with HIV and giving them a stem cell transplant as a cure, right? Again, very costly, very dangerous. And while he did remain negative for HIV, he did back in 2020, unfortunately, have resurgence of his leukemia and did pass from his leukemia, but did stay HIV negative.
And just because this has popped into my head, just to make sure, the chances of these three cases, I suppose, being false positives initially with HIV, that's not something that we believe to be the case at all, correct?
No, not at this point. I mean, the batteries of tests that have been done on all three of those patients have definitely confirmed at some point that they did have exposure to the virus. As for example, the Esperanza patient, she did have a detectable viral load, was put on HIV treatment. After that was stopped after her pregnancy, it never came back. So definitely confirm that they did have HIV at some point. Yeah, it's a good question.
Great, thank you.
So it sounds like the Esperanza patient, we might be learning some things from there that possibly, very possibly in the future could possibly lead to a vaccine or a preventative treatment. But thinking about patients who are currently living with HIV, what does this mean anything for them? Or does this really not change anything?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think what this does is it reinvigorates for those with HIV that a cure may be possible, and it's getting closer and closer daily. I think it also brings a reminder that while we may not have a cure yet, our current treatments can suppress the virus and help many folks living with HIV live an exceptional and long life. I think the key to all this right now is just remaining engaged in HIV care for those living with HIV. As we know that one of these days, HIV providers may be able to approach a patient and say, there's this, you know, very promising trial that we can enroll you in that may lead to a cure. And, you know, just my experience with working with many persons living with HIV when they're engaged in care, they're actually quite willing and excited to be involved in any sort of research that could lead to a cure. So I think this is going to further help us in that scientific space. So, you know, I encourage those who are not routinely engaged in care living with HIV to get reconnected so that we can find this answer once and for all.
Absolutely. I think that's an important point to make. What else should our listeners, the preceptors, the pharmacy preceptors, take away from this information?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always a good reminder that, again, another proven effective way to fight HIV is prevention, right? So even more exciting in this space, and I know I've already been here in the past talking about PrEP, but again, there's something new just here on the horizon, a newly approved long-acting injectable for PrEP, which I believe the brand name is Apretude or something, but it's cabotegravir, just it's a long-acting injectable that can be done every 2 months. So yes, our current oral options are immensely effective. This certainly is going to be a game changer for helping reduce HIV infections around the world, especially those who struggle with long-term adherence to oral therapy. But I think what this really is going to be a great opportunity is this could be a drug that's provided by pharmacists in the community setting, could be an opportunity for an injection site for patients to come in and be able to get that. Again, we're incredibly accessible as pharmacists. So this is just be great in terms of that accessibility to treatment, prevention, and impact. So I would just tell all of your listeners to stay tuned because this is going to be something that will be huge and can be a game changer for us as pharmacists in the coming months.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll just echo, I know that PrEP is already able to be prescribed independently in a couple of states in the country. Not many yet, but hopefully that's a harbinger of things to come. So,
yeah, absolutely.
Is Indiana one of those states?
Indiana is not one of those states.
Not yet.
We're working.
Not yet? Okay. We got work to do then.
Well, Alex, thank you so much for taking some time to speak with us on this topic today. It's really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you both for having me back on yet again.
And thank you all for joining us for this episode of the Pharmacy Preceptor Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please like or subscribe. We would love to hear from you on how we can make our podcast better. Please submit your comments to help us develop content that best serves you. Thanks, everyone.